6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Welcome to the Get Certified Together, created as part of Technicove, a free knowledge sharing website based in London. If you love our content, please like and subscribe from your favorite podcast player. Reach out to us via www.technicove.com for suggestions and collaborations.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Get Certified Together series. Now, in this week's episode, I'll be continuing our journey with AWS Security Fundamentals. Now, remember I told you there are some free of cost resources which are provided by AWS on their official website. So if you go on that, you check that out. Of course, I'll be providing link in the show notes as well. We are starting with security fundamentals. You have to create your own skill builder ID, which is nothing but a unique email ID you can use or any sort of ID you can use to create your own account and use that account to authenticate and get access to that those resources. These resources are pretty unique in a way because they start with basic. They cover security, but from the perspective of AWS, which of course makes sense because ultimately, we are doing AWS security specialist preparation, right? So you can check that out, security fundamentals link, and you can read it yourself as well. Like I said, it's pretty easy. The language is pretty straightforward and it's more in layman's term. But of course, I'm here for you guys. If you don't want to check that out, I'll be covering all the concepts which are covered as part of those security fundamentals on the link as well. So don't worry about that. What I want to tell you though, that still go on that link because it has some unique hyperlinks as well. So it will refer some web pages which you can further refer to understand more about each concept. So of course you are learning something which is pretty fundamental, but if you are finding something which is really exciting and you want to know more about that stuff, there are some unique web pages which are mentioned there and you can go and check that out to learn more about that particular technology or that particular concept which you feel like you should be learning more about it. But again, there is no point of going in detail in that because those are security fundamentals. And of course, we will be going in deep detail breakdown of each concept and each component as part of our official syllabus. So security fundamentals are completely different from what we will be doing as part of main syllabus learning or covering or ticking off those task statements, which are covered in each domain. So that's the whole idea behind today's episode. So it will be short one because, of course, I have released my previous episode just a week back. And in the time which I've got, I try to cover as many things as I can. And I will be going through some of the key concepts. And again, I said, I'll be not going in detail. So don't worry. It will be a quick walkthrough about different concepts. And I'll try to cover up each and every component in a brief overcount kind of way. So after this break, let's kick off our main episode. All right, welcome back. Now, if you're starting AWS journey for the first time, then you might hear this word regions and availability zones. They are nothing but the location where AWS has set up their own data center. Now, remember, we discussed about cloud computing basics way back when we were discussing about CCSP. As part of that, I mentioned that cloud is nothing but just another computer, means just another server, which you can access via internet, because that's one of the characteristics, if you remember, of cloud computing, which is broad network access. So you can access that cloud resource or resources, compute power, which is running on someone else's data center via your laptop, via your mobile. So that's the whole idea behind cloud computing. So one of the characteristics was broad network access. AWS also have their own data centers, which is no-brainer, right? Now, those data centers are located across the globe, and they term it as the regions, which you can find. And you, when you create a new AWS account, you can find out like all the regions which are available to you, as in you can create resources in those regions. Each region will then subsequently have multiple availability zones. Now, availability zones are nothing but a set of servers which are co-located in a premise, and those servers will be attached to same network, and they will be part of same facility. So all the resources which are relevant for data center to work, like heating unit, your ventilation, your power backup, everything, as part of a single availability zone, will be connected to a single grid, maybe, if I say. And there'll be, of course, multiple availability zones in a region. So that's why they claim that if you want to have high availability within a region, then place your application or place your virtual machines or deploy your workloads into different availability zones. So if one of the grid fails, your server, which is running on a different grid, of course, from your perspective, it's in a different availability zone. But in the AWS data center language, it's on a different grid connected to a different maybe circuit altogether. And if one of the availability zone goes down, your server, your workload, which is running as a replica on another availability zone, will be still working as expected. So always they ask, like, if you are creating a VPC, create with 3 or 4 subnets, means each subnet will be having its own tagging to a particular availability zone. So you can deploy your workloads in turn into particular subnet. And then, of course, VPC and networking will make sure that your workloads are connected to a different network, which is part of a different availability zone. And in turn, in physical terms, which is part of a different grid and different circuits and different physical within same location, but different premise or different set of servers altogether. So your application is always highly available. So regions and availability zone, I think those are the key terms. From security perspective, it will come in handy when we will talk about business continuity and disaster recovery. And of course, costing plays a major factor as well, because different regions have different prices based on particular location. Like if there's a data center which AWS created in UK, for example, they must be paying it in pounds. There is a more expensive real estate here compared to some other countries, maybe in Asia or maybe in Africa. They might be more expensive in a way, because there's another factors like proximity to other resources, or even the factors associated with the safety of the data center of the location. So everything plays a role, and it determines how much you as a customer need to pay when you're creating a workload in your particular region. Costing plays a big role, of course, in public cloud, and it will come really handy that when you are deploying your application, you should know where to place it. You cannot just randomly choose a region and just deploy it. Of course, from end user perspective, you will want your application to be near to maybe your location, because it will help in latency and maybe data residency issues as well. But still make sure that you check the costing part as well. So costing will come in really handy. Data residency is another issue. And of course, business continuity, disaster recovery. So all those different concepts will come in handy if you are, you know, you are well aware of regions and availability zone and concept around that. Now, another fundamental concept which they cover in their resourcing is data center security. I found it very interesting, because as an end user, we don't care about what data center security public cloud have, because we are sort of trusting them to make sure everything is secure. But I will share the link in the show notes. They have a nice web page where they have this virtual walk of their existing data center premise in maybe some random location. So of course, they don't name it that which location it is. And they have clearly mentioned that we keep all our locations as a secret, or not even secret, but as something which is not accessible to the general public, even consumers or even customers of the cloud. But you can read about data center security. It covers all the concepts around perimeter security, how they ensure that you have this active standby grids, and how heating, ventilation units, everything work, and what kind of physical and deterrent and preventive controls they have put in place from the physical control perspective. So data center security is covered there, but I don't think it's relevant that much for us, because as an end user, We are trusting AWS to make sure data center is secure. And to remember shared responsibility model, which we covered in the last week's episode, it completely takes this ownership of making sure that data center is secure from customer to the public cloud. It means that's one of the key reasons we are going with the public cloud at the first place, right? We don't want to have this headache of managing those parameter controls and security from ourselves. And but you can check that out, Vince. It's provided in the in that resourcing and security fundamental. So if you like it, if you are working in data center, and if you like me, I have worked in a lot of data centers. So I found it interesting how they are doing it. I didn't go in detail, but of course it was interesting to read about data center security as well. Now, next concept which I want to cover is around certification and compliance. Now, this is very interesting. Certification and compliance from the workload and application perspective is consumer's ownership. But of course, you as an end user can ask AWS, how can you claim that your data center or your premise, your infrastructure is compliant to maybe PCI DSS, maybe it's compliant to any other government laws and regulations. How you can ensure this particular fact means it's your right as a customer to ask AWS these questions, right? Because you're not responsible for those security. But if AWS comes and claims like their infrastructure is PCI DSS compliant, you as a consumer can ask the proof of that. It means it's completely normal in this capitalist business world. So AWS have this nice AWS artifact service. When you create your AWS account, you can log in into this service. You will get option of downloading all the compliance report for any sort of laws and regulation which you want to read about. So for example, I cannot show it because when I downloaded, I realized that this is something which you cannot display or you cannot share or you cannot have this kind of session with everyone. I have downloaded one for PCI DSS. It was encrypted file. It have a password protection and all those sort of thing. But once I decrypted it, once I was able to open the attachment, I had this full list of detailed description, like what sort of control around PCI DSS have been implemented by AWS on their infrastructure. So it is covering everything in detail, and it was really nice to read. And I think this is how AWS create trust between them and the consumers, because they are happy to share all this compliance report just to make sure that they are being honest, and what they are claiming that they are compliant is actually covered, and you can read those reports. So as an end user, as a customer, because the account which I use to download that report, it's just my personal account. And if they are sharing it to a personal user, of course, they can share to the organization as well. Now, one more thing which I highlighted in my notes here is only infra is compliant, not the workloads. Means this makes sense, because when they are claiming that their infrastructure is compliant and they have this PCI compliant servers and storage devices, doesn't mean if I am creating an S3 bucket or I am creating an EC2 instance, that will be compliant by default. I have to make sure that the compliance on my workload, my storage, my containers, my other services which I'm using on AWS, they are compliant in its own way as well. So compliance of infrastructure doesn't mean that compliance is also on the workloads. So if you are, say, if AWS is saying that they're networking, as in the backbone networking, they use SDN, by the way. I've read in multiple forums that they use software-defined networking, which is a nice concept. So if their SDN backbone network is compliant, doesn't mean the VPC which you are creating on top of that network is also compliant as well. So that's a completely separate layer, and it's completely abstracted from what you are doing as an end user on top of AWS infrastructure. Now, moving on from compliance and governance, another key security fundamentals which they talk a lot about is entry points or endpoints. Now, AWS, of course, give access to their services via APIs. APIs are nothing but those application programming interfaces which you can use to send web-based calls, and you, of course, will get response. You have to send all sort of authentication and keys and tokens as part of your request. Only then you will get the response back. So that will be covered as part of second topic, which we'll cover today, which is around IAM. But as of now, you just understand that there's a specific endpoint for each service, which you need to know before sending any API call. And each service, of course, is created in a particular region. Just now we covered in our one of the concept in this episode. So each service will be in specific region. Some of the services are global. I think S3, Route 53, I recall. These two are global services. CloudWAN is, I think, Is CloudVina global? I'm not sure CloudVina is global service. I think it is. So yeah, these are the global services, and they don't have any sort of region tagged in their URIs, but services like EC2 instance, your resolvers, they are a local or regional service, and their URL have a specific region or endpoint ID as well. So for example, I have written here, the format is pretty simple. You have protocol, you have service code, region code, amazon.aws.com. So for example, HTTPS, S3, then EUS2, amazon.com, something like that. So you have this whole URL as part of your endpoints, and you can use these endpoints to send the API calls to the AWS, and you will get response. Now, let's move on to the authentication bit, because just now we talked about authentication, right? Now, authentication is via IAM. IAM is nothing but Identity and Access Manager. It means AWS are pretty smart in a way, because they were sort of first to implement the cloud computing and sell it as a solution. So they have used their basic identity service as IAM name. They copyrighted it, and it's been pretty much used as a complementary service name for any IAM concept. But IAM itself is an AWS service. So there is no such service as Azure IAM. There is no such service as GCP IAM. But AWS IAM is the service which is dealing with AWS Identity and Access Management. Now, as part of Identity and Access Management, of course, it starts with users and group. Now, users are nothing but people like you and me who want to work on the cloud. Of course, now these days we have this concept of machine-to-machine communication as well. So users can be machines or workloads or containers or applications as well. And each application has their own service account. So service account is completely separate from user account. And you, of course, have a separate grouping form for service accounts. But for each department, maybe in your organization, you can put under a specific group, or maybe based on user type, maybe developers or testers in a different user group, maybe administrators in a different user group. So you can create all those funny sort of charts. And of course, it's recommended as well, because you don't want each user to have same sort of rights. You don't want your developers to have administrator level rights. And it's pretty normal in a use case way, because you want to make your organization secure, and you don't want everyone to have equal rights, and you don't want everyone to have same sort of permissions to work on the cloud. So least privilege, if you recall, there's a concept in CCSP as well. We read about it. So it can be implemented using these user end groups. Now, when I say that each you don't have equal rights, of course, it doesn't mean that you as an employee has an equal rights in your organization. So pun intended, means this rights is specifically from what you're allowed to do inside your cloud computing environment. Doesn't mean that you don't have rights as an equal user in your organization. You should deserve an equal right. As part of access methods, you have different ways. You can use username, password, you can use tokens, you can use access keys, and of course, you can use key pairs, which normally we use with our EC2 instances to SSH into our machines or to RDP into our machines. So we have different ways. Username password is nothing but keying in your username and password. It's as simple as that. You need tokens to ensure you have multi-factor authentication. So of course, when you create a new AWS account, or even for your personal lab, like just now I created one for this whole testing and this whole certification path. So my user account is already having multi-factor authentication. It's pretty easy to set up, and you can use any app which is provided and which is supported with AWS. Use multi-factor authentication. It's as basic as that. Access keys are nothing but unique keys and secrets which you can create for a particular user account. And mostly they are used in SDKs or different programmatic calls which you want to give. So it's not necessarily used by users in day-to-day life, but they are more into your codes and your programs which want authentication for some of the AWS services. And just now I mentioned that you have to send API calls to your AWS cloud computing services. As part of those calls, you can use these access keys for authentication and get yourself authorized. Now, of course, when we talk about identity and access management, we want to improve it. We want to make sure that it's always secure, because just think that identity and access management is kind of your first point which you need to make sure that it's secure. So just compare it with your house, maybe, that your house doesn't matter that what kind of security system it have inside, doesn't matter that what kind of locks individual door inside your house have. if your main door for the entrance is not secure, or maybe the lock is not secure, the keys are pretty basic and anyone can open it with a simple tools and, I don't know, a different kind of key, but it's fitting different multiple locks. So I'm not sure how thieves usually do it. So, but that's the key, right? You have to make sure that your entrance to your house or entrance to your infrastructure is secure. Now, just now we talked about data center security parameter need to be secure. Same way, your workloads for them entrance is your user account. So if your user account is not secure, your IAM is not built with all the recommended approaches, then it makes a big, big hole in your security paradigm of your organization. So IAM, I feel, is one of the key concepts which need to understand. And that's why I brought it up multiple times that IAM should be started first in this security specialist examination preparation. And trust me that I'll be doing the same thing. So as part of improving your IAM, what different services you can use. So some of them are mentioned in this security fundamentals as well. One of them is Secrets Manager. Now, Secret Manager is nothing but a nice AWS service which you can use to not only generate keys, password, username, everything. You can also store your own username credentials as part of that Secret Manager. Once you store them, you can, of course, encrypt them using AWS keys or your own customer managed keys. And you can then further use these secrets in your other programs and codes. So one of the project I mentioned you about that I recently deployed this application on EKS cluster, and the pods which are running on that EKS cluster are using the secrets from the Secret Manager. So I'm not putting in username and password as in literal values inside my pod manifest. What I'm doing is I'm using via Secret Manager. So pod is sending requests to Secret Manager and it's getting the username and password in real time. So that's one thing I did to improve my application, and Secret Manager is a nice to have service. Another bit is IAM Identity Center. Now, if you are using IAM as in just an IAM service in AWS, it's pretty tough to manage. And even if you use Terraform or CloudFormation or any other IAC tool, it's really hard to manage if you are using IAM. So what you can do is you can use AWS IAM Identity Center, which is a nice service provided by AWS. You can integrate that service with other identity providers. So for example, you can integrate with Azure AD or Microsoft Active Directory. And then Azure AD or Microsoft Active Directory, they have this whole mature solution of managing your user identities. And you can, of course, divide users into different groups. You can create different OUs around that. And each user will be then, of course, created in Azure AD or in Microsoft Active Directory. It will be synced to your AWS via this Identity Center service. And further, to add permission to that, you can use your IAM policies. So users will be managed in Azure, but your identity permissions are provided by AWS IAM policies. So it's a next level of improving your IAM services, because now you have this umbrella identity provider, which is having federated concept of identities, and AWS is just referring user identities from that service. It's a better improvement compared to a vanilla AWS IAM service. Means once you set up your own AWS account, you will realize that users and group, they are nice to have, but they are not scalable. And after some time, you will find that it's good to manage it via some external mature solution, which of course Microsoft and Azure provides. So that's one of the way, and AWS Identity Center just provides that. Another bit is STS. Now, STS is short-term tokens. I forgot the real full form of that, but STS, via STS, you can get short-term tokens, and these tokens you can then use as part of authenticating yourself. So what you will do is you can create a simple user who is only allowed to assume a role. That role further will have advanced permission, and you can then define the time duration around that role, that this role can be only assumed as in for like 4 hours or 2 hours, and after that will be revoked. And as part of that role assumption, AWS will give this STS token, which will be assigned to your user. So it's as simple as a developer who wants to wear a hat of administrator for 2 hours, and once that job is finished, they can take off their hat and they are back to their developer role and their basic permission. So STS provides just that use case, and it's pretty good. And it's used like quite extensively to improve the security paradigm again, because you don't want to assign AWS IAM policies, as in static policies, to all the users. Instead, what you can do is you can create these short-term roles, and each user can assume them for a short duration of time. Once their task is over, they can revoke that role. So that's the whole concept around IAM roles and STS. I'm pretty sure it will be covered more in detail when we will go into our AWS IAM concept as part of this whole security specialist examination. So don't worry about it. It's pretty new and it's pretty basic level which I'm covering. So maybe some bits are confusing, because of course I don't want to go in detail of each concept. But just so you know that there are different ways in which you can improve your IAM further. So AWS IAM is not the end goal. End goal is to improve that IAM by using Secrets Manager, using Identity Center, using STS, IAM roles. All those services help us improving IAM as a concept and IAM as a service as well. All right, that's it for today's episode. And if you like this episode, if you like the concepts around that which I covered, then of course, like and subscribe. I will be covering more security fundamentals as part of our upcoming episodes. And once we are finished with it, I'll see if there's any more requirement of covering more fundamentals from any other source. If not, then we will jump right away into our main syllabus and we will cover each domain, each task statement one by one. So let's wrap up these security fundamentals, and soon we'll be into our main big conceptual journey. So be with me, and soon we will be getting certified in AWS Security Specialist Examination. Goodbye and good luck.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Follow the show so you don't miss out, as we deliver piping hot topics every week.